Daniel 11, and we are going to finish today if we don't do anything else aside from just read these verses. So I'll be out next week in Camden. Whitney and I and Annabelle will be holding a gospel meeting with them. So I'm sure y'all will have a adequate Bible class. But we're going to finish chapter 11 today. Hopefully after that, I want to spend just 1 week with chapter 12, and then we'll be concluding the book of Daniel. But I'm going to try things a little bit differently today. Personally, I felt that we got lost a little bit in the reading just as we looked at such large portions of the text last week and then try to remember everything. So I'm just going to kind of take this a little bit, a verse at a time, and see if we can handle no more than two or three verses at a time. And I'll just give brief explanations of what's taking place. So just to keep in mind, this will be the only slide we have today. This is the map of the King of the North and the King of the South that we've spent the last couple of weeks talking about, and you've got Jerusalem identified down there. We're going to see Jerusalem changing hands in our study today in this text. So let's pick up in verse 17 where we left off. We left off with Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great. He had gone down into Egypt, but he'd been rebuffed by the Romans, and he'd been sent packing by the Romans. But it was finally in verses 15 to 16 where he finally gained a foothold into that very desirable portion of Syria where Israel, where Jerusalem was at. So that's where we left off the text, was with him returning back to Jerusalem. Remember verse 16 ended saying that he would stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand, meaning that he had possession of that area. He had the power to take away, to destroy, to give life, to do whatever he would have done with that country. Not necessarily to destroy, but that he simply had the power to do so. So let's pick up our reading, look at verses 17 through 19. He, the king of the north, will set his face to come with power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will pull into effect. He will also give him, the king of the south, the daughter of women to ruin it. But she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So he will turn his face toward the fortresses of his own land. He will stumble and fall and be found no more. So once again in verse 17, this is the second really prearranged marriage in an attempt to sue for peace that has taken place over this 150-year period of the six Syrian wars. So you've got Antiochus III, who gives his daughter, Cleopatra I, and she's not the Cleopatra that was famous for being with Mark Antony and all of that that we may remember in history, but further down the lineage, she named her daughters Cleopatra, and somewhere along the line, the famous Cleopatra that we know came from her lineage. But Cleopatra I was given by the king of the north to the king of the south, and it's obvious his intent when doing so was to gain some sort of influence and gain some sort of foothold in Egypt. This has already been tried before. And so he will give his daughter, or he will give him the daughter of women to ruin it. He's thinking that she's going to be able to be influential in the Ptolemaic kingdom and the Ptolemaic dynasty, and that she's going to assist and give him a foothold down there. But as Daniel's identified in verse 17, he's going to give her as a proposal of peace so that she might ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. So the result of that effort being, she marries one of the Ptolemies, the king of the south, and she does not do what her father intended for her to do. She remains loyal to the family she married into. And so rather than enacting all of these laws and making things easier for Antiochus III, she's more loyal to the Ptolemies. And in doing so, she doesn't allow her father to accomplish what he sought to accomplish in enacting policies that would be favorable for his kingdom. So she stands with her husband, she stands for the Ptolemies, and he's not going to find the success in that marriage that he was hoping to find. Okay, verse 18 says he's going to turn his face toward the coastlands, he's going to capture many, but a commander will put a stop to him, to his scorn against him. Now remember, previously he'd already entered down into Egypt and he was doing well. 15 or 20 years ago he went down there on a conquest and he was taking over some of the Egyptian lands, taking over some of the Ptolemy's kingdom. Rome, however, stepped in and said, you need to back off. Remember, Egypt being the fertile land that it was a great producer of grain And a lot of that was given over to the Romans, or sold to the Romans, to fund their great kingdom and their great military. And so the Romans, when they realized what Antiochus III was doing, they said, you need to get out here. So verse 18, we just read about this commander that was going to stop his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. That's once again the Romans coming in and saying, you need to leave Egypt alone. And this was really the last straw. And what they did, because Rome was so powerful at this point in time, was they imposed on the Seleucids, the king of the north, and his people, they imposed on them a war tax because of all of the involvement of Rome's army in putting a stop to what was taking place between these two warring dynasties. They said, you're going to have to pay us a tax to fund the military expenses that we've had to use to intervene. And so he rebuffs him. He sends him back. Verse 18 says he repays him, the scorn against him. And we see in verse 19, king of the north, he turns his face toward the fortress of his own land. So he does leave Egypt. He returns back home. But it says he's going to stumble and fall and be found no more. And really, the result of Antiochus III's attempt to pay this tax, he was invading his own kingdoms, his own dynasties, and he was raiding the possessions that were there, raiding various temples, and it was in one of these temple raids, in an attempt to pay back Rome, that he meets his end, that he was eventually killed. So that's what's meant by he will stumble, and he will fall, and he will be found no more. And thus comes the end of the reign of Antiochus III, and we're going to see a shift here in the chapter. This is really what everything was building for, and this is where we are brought here to the crux of this vision. So the stage has been set for the arrival of perhaps the greatest persecutor that Israel will have seen at this point in time in their history. And as you read through the text, you can't help but wonder, why did the Holy Spirit see fit to include these details about these two warring nations in here? Really, what do you think God has in mind? You know, we think back to Babylonian captivity. And this is after the people have been released from Babylonian captivity. But God used the Babylonians to punish Israel for their sins and for their crimes, for their disobedience throughout their long history toward God. And so they endure Babylon captivity for 70 years. And then once again, by the hand of Cyrus, you know, God working behind the scenes, Cyrus signs the edict that allows the children of Israel to return home and to begin rebuilding their city and rebuilding their wall. So you see God using these various nations to bring about his desired results. The Babylonians to punish, the Medes and the Persians to send them back. And as we're going to see, the Greeks, specifically Antiochus IV, he used to purify the people. And we've made mention of this before, that how the previously throughout Israel's history, they'd always wavered and they'd always fought with idolatry. But this great, terrible persecutor is going to come in, and he's going to really test the faith of God's people. And he's going to, I believe, as we're going to see in verse 35, he's going to refine, he's going to purge those who aren't truly loyal to God. And after this great persecution on his hand comes to an end, and God raised him up, God gave him this power, he persecutes the Jews, God's going to bring him down, as we're going to see as the chapter concludes. But never again in Israel's history do they deal with this specific issue of idolatry. God, in a sense, has used these various nations to bring about the restoration of his people. This is what he's desired all along. You shall have no other gods before me. He wanted the relationship between his people and himself to be exclusive. And at this point in time, through the events of this great persecution, that's finally what we see coming about. And what God's had on his mind from the very beginning has been restoration. And all of this pointing toward the fact that later there was going to come one who would make good on what it was the people desired. That relationship with God, a closeness that they'd never known, true atonement that they'd not experienced. And so all of these things, I believe we can see, are setting up to bring Jesus onto the scene. However, what first must be accomplished is that God's people need to be purified. So the hypocritical and the idolatrous, they've got to be weeded out. And I think that's what we see in a large part done at the hands of Antiochus IV. So let's look at Antiochus IV. It's actually, his story is going to begin in verse 21. Verse 20 says, in his place, after Antiochus III died, he was killed raiding the temple. In his place, one will arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. Yet within a few days he will be shattered, not in anger or not in battle. And so verse 20 is talking about the second son of Antiochus III that rises up, that reigns for a little while, and he's still trying to pay his father's debt to the Romans. And so you see there in verse 20, he will arise, he'll send an oppressor through the jewel of the kingdom, talking about Jerusalem, trying to collect that tax so that they can pay the Romans off for all that they've done. Yet his attempt was ultimately going to fail, and he was going to die, he was going to be poisoned. And so some have thought, well, that's Antiochus the IV doing, his other son, that, as we're going to see, comes in and takes the kingdom by intrigue. He dies in verse 20. He's shattered, and it's not through anger, it's not through battle, but rather it's through the deceit of his brother. So in verse 21, we pick up with Antiochus, and we see, in his place, a despicable person will arise, on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And so this despicable person that's being described here is who we looked at back in chapter 8 and who we've been talking about up until this point in chapter 11. That's Antiochus the IV. And it's no doubt Daniel's people, the Jews, would see him this way. When you consider, when they look at history and when they look back at the events of what this terrible person did, that's how he'd be described. He'd been one of the most hated tyrants that the Israelites ever found themselves in submission to. He was a despicable person because of his hatred toward the Jews and toward their religion and their belief and his persecution that's going to be talked about a little bit later on. So he seized the kingdom by intrigue. What he did, he kind of made his way in, and unlike all of the other kings, you know, they sat up on their throne and they gave the commands. Antiochus, previously a prisoner of Rome, makes his way back, usurps the throne, poisons his brother. There's the intrigue part. And he starts trying to make friends with the common man, integrating himself into polite society. Something's very uncommon for a king to do. So he flattered the people, much like Absalom. You'll remember Absalom, David's son. He stood at the gate, and people that come in, he would make friends with the common man, and he won the hearts of the people, essentially. And that's how he was able to run David out of the kingdom for that period of time, by flattering the people. And Antiochus is going to follow a similar pattern. He's going to interject himself into society with the common man. He's going to win the people over for a time. Continuing on in his place, the despicable person is going to arrive. Verse 21, verse 22, the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. An alliance will be made with him. He will practice deception. He will go up and gain power with a small force of people. So this is his coming into authority in the Seleucid Empire. In verse 24, in a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors before him. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. And so he's given the throne for a period of time. As we're going to see, it's God who raises up, and it's God who will eventually cast down. But we do see he did have some success, and history corroborates this for us. He did have some success that his fathers didn't. Previously, Antiochus I, II, and III had tried to make their way down into Egypt and capture the land. The most successful attempts had been by his father, but yet Antiochus is able to slip down into Egypt and go beyond and above what his fathers were able to do. And he captured most of Egypt with the exception of Alexandria. So that's kind of a summary of his reign. And when you look at it from simply the historical perspective, he was going to accomplish what his fathers never did accomplish. So let's take just a moment. We're going to jump into verses 25 through 28 here in just a minute. But let me set the background for what's taking place between the Jews and Antiochus the IV at this time. There was this public friction between the Jews and between the Seleucids, specifically who was on the throne at the time, Antiochus the IV. And it arose really in relation to money and to the high priesthood. During the day when Antiochus IV came onto the throne, the legitimate high priest, and you'll remember that followed a very specific dynasty. Only certain people of a certain lineage were allowed to serve as high priest. That is, they had to tie in directly to the lineage of Aaron. And it was only those who were allowed to serve as high priest. At the time of Antiochus the Fourth came onto the throne, there was a legitimate high priest on the throne by the name of Onias the Third. However, as corruption begins to take place and spread from the Greeks to the Jews, one of the Israelites, a man by the name of Jason, not necessarily of the lineage of Aaron, goes to Antiochus, realizing this guy can be bought. He's got all of these taxes he needs to pay back. And so he bribes him essentially, hey, will you kick this guy out of the high priesthood, and will you give me that position? I got a bunch of money I'll give you if you go about doing this. And so essentially he bribes his way into this position of high priest during the reign of Antiochus the Fourth. Well, having shown himself that he can be bought, another man by the name of Menelaus comes in and usurps, does the exact same thing that Jason had done. He goes and he says, well, I'll pay you more than this other guy did. So, hey, he'd already done it once, why not do it again? There's an opportunity to gain some tax that he can put toward his debt toward the Romans. So he deposes Jason of that high priesthood, and he allows Menelaus to come in, and he makes him king, or makes him high priest, rather. So at this, Onias, who is essentially the one that's supposed to be serving as high priest, he's angered at this. He protests at this. However, Menelaus doesn't like how he's stirring up the people, and so he essentially has the legitimate high priest killed. Well, this angers the people, and so they send this formal complaint to Antiochus the Fourth, expressing what had been done by Menelaus, the corruption that had taken place. And Menelaus, once again, using his techniques of bribing and this corruption, he bribes someone on the court, one of Antiochus' advisors, to say, hey, you need to really shut these Jews up. They're starting to become a problem. And so, having received that advice, Antiochus the Fourth is going to strike out against the Jews. So, that's really the events that take place historically that are going to bring us through most of the rest of the text. And so, you can tell there's a tenuous relationship between the current king of the north and between the Jewish people. The king of the north has shown himself corrupt. He'll receive these bribes. He'll put different people who are favorable for him or who will give him money in various positions of influence among the Jews. And so he doesn't have this real good relationship with them to begin with. So let's just go ahead and continue and finish a little more of our reading. Verse 25, Antiochus the Fourth, king of the north, is going to stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a larger army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. So as his father had done, Antiochus IV prepares to move into Egypt. And as we see, Egypt's unable to stand against his power. Verse 26, those who eat, this is the king of the south, those who eat his choice foods will destroy him. His army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. And so due to the poor advice of the Ptolemies, the kingdom is given almost into the hands completely of Antiochus the Fourth. When we come to verse 27, we see as Antiochus now has the upper hand, and the king of the north is threatening the king of the south's position, these two, both kings, the king of the north and king of the south, their hearts will be intent on evil. They will both speak lies to one another at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. So as they sit down together to work out some sort of plan, each one has his own desires in his own mind. King of the South is simply looking for a means to an end, and if Antiochus will help push him to the forefront of control of Egypt, then he's willing to allow him to gain control. Antiochus himself, what he wants is once again that foothold down in Egypt. And so they're both working, using one another to work toward their own individual goals. Verse 27 says it's not going to succeed. This isn't the point in time that the end is going to come. We're going to see that end coming a little bit later on. Verse 28 is an important verse. Then we see he will return. Antiochus will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. So after conquering much of Egypt, as he seeks to return back home, he hears of this insurrection that's taking place in Jerusalem. And his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. You'll remember Antiochus is everything Greek. He tries to push this Greek culture and the Greek religion and the Greek way of living upon all of the people that live within his domain. And so hearing these Jews, they're resistant to his attempts to Hellenize the nation, his heart was set against the Holy Covenant. This was his motive for his actions against the Jews. And this insurrection would serve as a legitimate excuse for punishing the people. So Daniel tells us of the motives of Antiochus the IV, having rejected the religion of the Greeks. Antiochus is going to go in and he's going to make things tough on the Israelites. Verse 29, at the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time it will not be the way that it did before. The ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened and return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsook his Holy Covenant. Previously, his endeavors in Egypt were very successful. Verse 30 says, these ships of Kittim will come against him. You probably know who that is. Once again, Rome is stepping in and saying, leave Egypt alone. So Rome's going to step in. They're going to stop his entrance into the land of Rome, his pillage on the land of Egypt. They're going to send him back. Having been beaten essentially by the Romans, or threatened to the extent that he's now got to leave Egypt, forsake that conquest, now's a good time to attack those pesky Jews that have been stirring up trouble. Verse 30, he became enraged at the Holy Covenant, and he takes action. So he'll come back and show regard for those who forsook the Holy Covenant. Verse 31, forces from him will arise, and this is his persecution on the Jews in earnest. Forces from him will arise. They will desecrate the sanctuary fortress. They will do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. And so you'll remember, he's going to enter into Jerusalem. He's going to begin persecuting the Jews. He's going to have many of them killed that resist. He's going to go into the temple. He's going to lay hands on the sacred vessels and those things that God had said that the Gentiles simply weren't to touch. That's the abomination of desolation, entering into the temple. This Gentile king, this corrupt Gentile king going in. Verse 32, by smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, and the people who know their God will display strength and take action. So you got two groups of people here. You've got the godless among the Jews that are progressive and forward-thinking, and they think they know which way the wind's blowing, so they side with the Greeks. They embrace this process of Hellenization. They worship the Greek gods. They sue for all of the Greek culture coming in, the Olympics that are to take place, the games that are to take place. They're first on the forefront to participate in them. You've got those who've given over and who are essentially casting in their lot with the Greeks, with Antiochus. But you've also got this other group in verse 32 that know their God and display strength and take action. And we could go into a lot of detail about the Maccabees, who withstood and riled up the people and caused this insurrection and resisted many of them to the point of death, Antiochus's attempts to Hellenize the people. You've got those two essentially that side with Antiochus, and then you got those that remain true to the Lord. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to many. The Maccabees were able to stir up a number of people to hold true to their principles, to their teachings, and to their God. Yet they will fall by the sword and by flame and captivity and by plunder for many days. So this is, once again, the persecution that falls upon God's people at the hand of Antiochus. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help. Many will join them in the hypocrisy. Some who have insight will fall in order to hear, and here's the verse we mentioned a couple times, to refine, to purge, and to make them pure until the end time, because it's still to come at the appointed time. So this persecution, this suffering, this death at the hands of Antiochus IV, those that side with him, they're going to fall when Antiochus falls. Those who are true, those who resist, those who have this knowledge and put their faith in God, they're going to be purified. Israel's being purified as a people through the hands of this wicked ruler. Verse 36, then the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and he will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, till God puts a stop to him, for that which is decreed will be done. And you'll remember he's exalted himself above all of the kings and all of the gods. He calls himself Theos, Epiphanes, God manifests. He takes the coins, and previously they bore the emblem of Zeus. He puts himself on the back of the coins. God manifests. He exalts himself over all of the gods of his people. Verse 37, he shows no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor does he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. So that just talks once again how he puts himself above and beyond the gods that his father served, claiming himself to be a god. Verse 38 and 39, he will honor a god of fortress, having come from Rome and its influences, rather than serving Zeus, as many of the Greeks in this area did. He favors the Roman god, Jupiter. And so that's what verse 38 is talking about. He will honor a god of fortresses. From Rome, he got that influence. Jupiter, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with silver, gold, costly stones, and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses. With the help of a foreign god, he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him. And he will cause them to rule over many, and will parcel out the land for a price. And that's where you get the bribing taking place. Those who were willing to pay the price, he'll put them in power. The land will be parceled out for a price. In these last five verses, at the end of the time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with the many ships. And he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. Once again, this is the persecution that's taking place. He will enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand: Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. He will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. So once again, he enters down into Egypt, but he's, as the Romans have done, there's a price to pay for entering down into Egypt and intruding on that portion of land. As he's down there, verse 44, rumors from the east and rumors from the north will disturb him. And he will go forth with great wrath and destroy and annihilate many. So he gets word while he's down making conquest on Egypt. He gets word of an insurrection back in the north and back in the east. And you can see his kingdom there, the Parthians from the north and the Armenians, I believe, from the east, begin uprisings of their own. And as he begins to realize his dynasty is starting to collapse from within, collapse on itself, he's forced to go back home and to address those issues. In verse 45, it kind of concludes his wicked reign. He will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and between the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. So he's persecuted the Jews. He's begun invading Egypt. He hears of this great rumor of war back home. He has to go back home to deal with that. And this is really where his reign ends. Somewhat insignificantly, he doesn't die on the battlefield. He doesn't die as a result of conquest. I think I've mentioned before, he simply died of a fever. It's kind of unknown as to the source of his death. And so his end was going to come. He'd been risen up by God. But as God had promised the Jews, this time of persecution is going to come to an end. The same man God brought high, he brings him low. His time would come to an end. No one would be there to help him. And he spends his last days dying of a fever. And no one's there to really help this man as he hands his throne over to his successor. So, promised we're going to finish Daniel 11. You probably didn't believe me. But in a very small nutshell, that is the description of what we see taking place. And Daniel has laid this out for us historically. We're going to find out in the 12th chapter, 2 weeks from today, as we conclude the book of Daniel, what Daniel was told to do. Remember, less impressive for us as we look back and we see these things have already happened. But wouldn't you know it had to be interesting for people during the days of this wicked king to, as they look for hope and as they wonder when these terrible events are going to come to an end, they read the things that Daniel's written. And they're reminded and they're shown God knows. God sees his people suffering. And this time of suffering is going to come to an end. It served its purpose to purify the people, to bring them back to God, to restore their faith in Jehovah, and to remove all of those that were hypocrites and that were unfaithful and that worshiped the idols and sided with the Greeks and their gods. They were removed as a result of this wicked man as he arose.
But the faithful Jews persisted.
They were delivered by the hands of God. And so once again, we're reminded the same lesson King Nebuchadnezzar was taught back in chapter 4. God reigns. in the kingdom of men. And it's ultimately God who raises up tyrants like Antiochus the Fourth, and it's also God that hears the cries of his people when they suffer and brings them low and repays them for their wickedness. So I know that's a lot to process, but it's a lot of chapter, it's a lot of history. Any comments, any questions, anything anyone would like to say adding to our study from Daniel 11? All right, well, I appreciate everyone's forbearance, as I know we've dealt with a very challenging part of the chapter. I know I've done most of the talking. I don't like doing that necessarily. I do like to get some of the input, but just as we've considered the history of what's taking place, I so much appreciate your patience and your attention throughout the course of this. So we'll conclude Daniel, Lord willing, 2 weeks from today. You may read that chapter ahead of time to be prepared for the conclusion to this wonderful book that we've been privileged to study. So thank you for your attention this morning.